Hello, and welcome to a special 4th of July episode of Breaking Geek Radio, the podcast, the premier podcast of LRM Online. I'm your host, Brandon Jones, and I got to sit down and talk with actor Sidney Harcourt about a multitude of topics to include his role in Hamilton, which is premiering on Disney Plus this holiday weekend. So sit back, relax, and enjoy, and I'll be back with you after the interview. So first of all, Sidney, thank you for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
Oh, brother. My pleasure.
Okay. And so I understand that you have a hard time, so I'm not going to try to keep you for too long. But I do want you to tell me, what is it that you're doing after you're done talking to me? Don't make that face. You knew I was going to ask.
I am participating in a Hamilton film watch party. So, Animal Crossing, called Hamimal Crossing.
Right. That sounds awesome.
So, you know, all of us who have created our avatars and have been living the Animal Crossing lifestyle can participate. So, I, you know, made a little Hamilton-themed T-shirt. To celebrate it, and had my avatar put that girl on, and then we're gonna party in the digital world.
Okay.
Yeah, about 4 o'clock. I mean, you know how it is.
So, okay, then let me ask you. So, you are on a show called Breaking Geek. I have to ask you: are you a lifelong gamer? Is this something that you found since quarantine? Because there are a lot of people since quarantine happened. You know, the gamer came out of them, like they're looking around. Shit, I need something to do. And video games seems to be the thing. So has this always been you, or is this a new thing?
I ain't new.
Okay.
I've been playing. I mean, you know, my mom, I can't believe I'm about to tell this story, because for like my entire life, I have begged my mom to stop telling this story. But I remember when I was a kid, like all I would do was ask for quarters so that I could go to the local like pizza store, the 7-Eleven, that I could play video games in. When I was really little, there was this one pizza place that had a bunch of like pinball machines and some like, you know, video games like Pac-Man or whatever. And I had gotten on a really high level of, I think it was Pac-Man. And I'm going and I really had to go to the bathroom, but that meant losing the game. So, you know, I just stood there and wet my and kept playing. So you ask, I'm a lifelong gamer.
Have you ever peed your pants playing games? That's how much of a gamer I am. I love it.
Yeah, and then you know, I played Pong. I played Jumpman. I played, you know, the first Mario, and I remember getting that star the first time, and you know, getting through that first level the first time, so you could hear that boo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, and I was hooked. It was like crack, that sense of accomplishment, the endorphin rush that comes with it, right? So I never, there was a period, I would say, I left gaming when I went to boarding school for the arts. And I mean, we weren't allowed to have anything, right? So I kind of checked out for a long time. But then when the Wii came out, I was back in because of Mario Kart. I played Mario Kart like a fiend when I was a kid. And And I've been back ever since. I mean, I am playing right now. I just, I'm playing Mario Tennis all the time. I am ranked in, I don't know what my current ranking is, but I'm generally ranked in the top 10 in North America and in the top 100 in the world in Mario Tennis. I have beaten, you know, Breath of the Wild.
Probably. Serena Williams. Oh, okay.
I'm just beat Star Wars. Is it Rise of the Jedi? The
Fallen Order.
Fallen Order. I just beat Fallen Order. Amazing story. Mm-hmm. Emotional. Like
yes.
Like really surprising. I loved it.
And I had one criticism, but I really liked it.
What is that?
I don't, so I feel bad. So spoilers for anybody that hasn't finished the game. I thought that the game did a really good job of utilizing new places and new characters, all this other stuff. And then within the last 30 minutes of the game to bring Darth Vader into the game, it felt like a cheat.
I will agree with you. Although the thing that I liked about that, the at least about that moment, was that I was legitimately scared.
Yeah.
I actually was scared. However, you're right. I think a better way would have been to, if you're going to bring some, you know, bad boss along, give me somebody fresh, right? Mm-hmm. Give me somebody fresh.
And the one thing that I would have been curious to see them do, especially having seen Rise of Skywalker, is to see whether or not they could have taken her name just jumped out of my head.
Trilla.
But yeah, Sarah. If they could, the Inquisitor.
Trilla.
Okay. So if they could have taken her and redeemed her, I would like to see what actual redemption looks like in the Star Wars universe, where you've done something just so evil, but you don't just die. You have to live with that. What does it look like to live in the Star Wars universe, having done terrible things? And so that was kind of the thing that got me thinking about that story, but they just ended it so quick.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I agree with you, because, I mean, I think some of our best, you know, to relate it to Aaron Burr, like, you know, Hamilton sort of takes this character that is, in my estimation and history's estimation, truly like an evil, vile, self-serving, mystical person, and puts him in the position of having to apologize for all of those things and try at least to explain it to the audience in a way to make them understand it's right. And at the end, that moment of the world was wide enough for both of us, I should have known. But I will say that moment, you know, you talk about some of the computer acting that's happening and the face capture, like that moment when Trilla says, I have carried so much hate for you for so long. And then you see her face relax, and it's like you get to see the person that she was for a second.
Second, yeah.
Right? That was heart-wrenching for me. Like,
yeah.
It was really heart-wrenching. And then, let's see, I kind of went on a, I caught up a little bit. I played through Horizon Zero Dawn, which I loved. On this quarantine, I went old school and played Lords of Shadow.
Nice.
Castlevania. I bought a PS3, not knowing at the time that I could just get it off of PS Now. So then when I figured that out, then I did the next one, the Lords of Shadow 2, which, you know, got a lot of criticism. I still ended up liking it because I love the controls and the gameplay and the darkness. Yeah. But, you know, I hear people. I hear them. I still loved it. And now I'm in the remake of Final Fantasy.
Okay. So, and it's funny because I've heard mixed things about that. A lot of people that have played it, you know, way back when it first came out on the PlayStation 1, there are people who have, are one side or the other. I was not a Final Fantasy guy growing up. So I have no stake in the game, but it is interesting to listen to people talk about that.
I have no horse in the race myself.
Yeah.
The last Final Fantasy I played before this one, was it ever on Nintendo Final Fantasy? Because the one I played was like, yeah, that's the one I played. It was like bit matrix, like, you know, the electricity comes down like, you know, crazy. And yep. You have all the time to choose. It was like a traditional, like, computer RPG. So right. For me, this is just like, it's this. Coming to it from, you know, the needy person who is stuck in their house and really needs a new game, I'm feeling it.
Okay. So I like what you did there. I feel like you've done interviews before because, you know, we're talking about video games, but you're able to bring it back to Hamilton. And so I do want to ask you some questions about that. And first off, congratulations on the success of Hamilton. I can't even imagine what that's like to be part of a worldwide phenomenon. What has that been like for you?
Every day it dawns on you a little more. How much it means to people, how much it means to the world, how much it means to the theater community. Because inside of the bubble, especially when I was doing the show and when we were making it, and, you know, from the workshop to, you know, through the Broadway run and then taking over Aaron Burr, that was like a good at least 3 years for me. And inside of it, it literally feels like, you know, holding on for dear life because of 8 shows a week, because of covering 5 roles, because of, you know, the acupuncture and the physical therapy and the chiropractic and just the lifestyle you live when you do 8 shows a week and, you know, you don't get to see people. You know, your life is that thing. You're not really aware of, like, what it really means to people. You know, as somebody who's done theater your whole life, like, man, you're used to people saying, you know, hey, so you're an actor, you say, what have you been in? And then you're like,
anything I've seen.
Yeah, I was in, you know, American Idiot. And they're like, I don't know, I didn't see that. And right. No, they didn't. They're like, I did Bells Are Ringing. Hmm? Or
Lion King.
You say Lion King, but at that point, you know, Lion King becomes such a, you know, is such a, like, it's been around for so long at this point. Sure. Just sort of like a lot of people have that credit. Not impressed.
Did they ask you whether or not you met Beyonce?
Well, you know, they asked me, the question I used to get is, I know acting is what you want to do, but, you know, what do you really do? What do you do to pay the bills? And so saying Hamilton is like an immediate, like, what? Right?
Yeah.
So that is, you know, that's satisfying as an actor to have been in a show that has pierced the national consciousness in such a profound way. But that said, we never could have known, you know, people ask a lot in interviews and just in life. Did you know back when you first started this, that did you have that feeling that it was going to be this thing? And the answer is no, because you can't, when you are used to doing off-Broadway theater, when you're used to doing developmental theater in workshops, you are used to working for very little and doing a lot of work for the love of it. And hopefully you can get your agent to come watch, right? You know, hearing the material and reading through it and doing those first workshops, I think we all kind of figured this will be the best thing on Broadway, whatever season it goes to Broadway, if it gets produced, you know, fingers crossed. Yeah. We could not have imagined the flashpoint it became, that we would go to the White House, that I would meet Obama 3 times, that I would meet Michelle Obama's mama, that I would, you know, be on, you know, at the Grammys and making a film of it, you know, meeting Nancy Pelosi and, you know, every A-list star that you've seen in a film and loved, and getting to talk to them and having them, like, tell you about what your work means to them. Yeah. And so there's no way, you know, you can say with truth, oh yeah, I knew that was going to happen. We did not know that was going to happen, because as far as musical theater goes, it's not something that had happened.
Sure.
Now, I think we're at the same point again. I think that we all made this film. We had no idea when it would be released. it was a secret for a long time that we had even done it. And I honestly was betting on like 15 years.
And before it came out.
Before it came out. I really thought that. I thought it would be something that they kept locked away and let the show, like that maybe when the show stopped selling tickets or if it ever happened, if the show slowed down, they'd re-hype it with releasing the original cast. When I found out in March that this was coming out in July, it was just like, you know, like, well, and then it felt like, oh my God, that's so long. Like, you know, I can't believe I have to wait. And now it's like, how did time pass fast?
Yeah.
And we don't know. We don't know what it's going to do. We don't know how it's going to change our lives. We don't know how it's going to affect the people who need to see this film, the people who this film is going to be most impactful for, who never had a chance of seeing it
in theater,
and now have this opportunity to watch it on their phones, on their computer, on their TV. We don't know what that's going to do and how that's going to change and how it's going to change us. So I'm in this state of sort of like, you know, anticipation and but excitement, because I know that it's a beautiful work that was made with love, and so I know it's going to be something good, but I just don't know what.
I think one of the things that you touched on is probably one of my favorite things about this coming to the small screen, and it's basically the democratization of this thing that for so long people couldn't get tickets to see, you know, it was such a big deal. And now people who never, like you said, would have had a chance to see this, are just going to be blown away by it. Like, it's one thing to hear it and to hear the music. And it's super weird that I'm talking to you now, because I had no idea I was going to be talking to you today. And on my way home, the soundtrack came on. What Did I Miss? Came on, and then I got home, and then my wife was like, let's watch this, we're gonna watch this now. And the kids were just sitting there, they're just in the screen. So my children are 4 and 5, and my son's name is actually Alexander, and so it's very weird watching them like super into it. And every time they say Alexander Hamilton, my daughter who's 4 will poke my son who's 5, and you know, they never would have had the opportunity to see this in the theater for like years and years and years from now. But the ability to enjoy this with them now, you know, it does mean a lot. It's a lot of fun, because my wife and I we've seen it in the theater, and we've had conversations about it. But to be able to share it with our kids and have them see people that look like them, and then even have my son hear his name, it means a lot. And so I'm doing the thing that you said. I'm doing the thing. So it does mean a lot.
It has so many implications, not just for, you know, having the kids see themselves represented, people of color up there on stage, but it's not that they just that they can see themselves in leading roles on Broadway, or that they can, that there can be colorblind casting. It's that they can see themselves as politicians.
Yeah.
They see these presidents being played by people of color, of all colors, and then they think that that's something they can do, these 4 and 5 year olds, versus what we're, a lot of us are socialized to believe early on, that our lives are going to be harder, that we don't have the choices, that we don't have the options, and here's a show to come along and tell you, sky's the limit, be what you want to be, you've got the time, so use it wisely. It'll also create, I think, a whole new generation of artists, because when I was 4, I saw Singing in the Rain on TV, on a TV this big in my mom's kitchen, and that I saw it and I was like, that exists. That's what I want. That's where, how do I get that? How do I get there? I went out in the rain with an umbrella and danced until my mom grabbed me and said, get your ass back inside. And it was, I'll never forget it. I remember the colors. I remember seeing it when I was 4. And listening to albums like Free to Be You and Me. Mm-hmm. This could be that new thing. and I can't believe my voice is there. It's just bigger than I dreamed.
That is super exciting. I'd like to ask you a serious question while I've got you on the horn.
Yeah.
So you all, the cast, made an appeal to then-elect, Vice President-elect, Mike Pence. You guys, yeah. You know, you asked that they uphold the American ideals and things of that nature. And that was years ago. I think that was 4 years ago at this point. I remember when it happened. I remember that being a big story.
Yeah.
In light of that appeal and seeing what's happening in our country now, you know, can you talk to that at all? Like, what it was like to be on that stage, to be able to speak truth to power and have that conversation and see what's happening now?
Well, it felt like it was satisfying, because anybody who can just at a moment's notice get a ticket to Hamilton is living in a world of privilege.
Sure.
Or connection. And the temerity for someone who has, advocated for gay conversion therapy to come into my house and sit with his family as, like, you know, in the you know, the run up to what they see as a successful election, you know, when they're cheating, you need to be spoken to. Truth needs to be spoken to you, and you put yourself in that position, damn right, you better sit there and listen. And it felt great. It felt satisfying, and it felt like a moment that we all needed. I can't tell you how many people have come to me and thanked me. I didn't write that statement. But they thank me as a member of Hamilton for that moment, because it meant so much. And, you know, in the same way that Mitt Romney's candidacy really pulled the curtain back on wealth in America, we didn't have language like the 99% and the 1% before he ran. And one of the things that it really showed us was, whoa, here we all thought we were doing okay, and turns out we have nothing, and that they have everything, and they keep taking it and changing the laws so that the system favors them, and when they screw up, we bail them out with our money, they give themselves bonuses, and right. They keep going. And I had the same thought, you know, when Trump got elected, I was like, okay, great, because this is going to pull the curtain back on the racism and the inequality that goes on around here. And look what has happened. We have come together as a people in a way that we haven't in decades, maybe ever, because we're so fed up. Sometimes it takes something like a Trump to shake you out of your reverie of the Kardashians and The Bachelor so that you can see what's really happening in the world outside.
That's important. Yeah.
You know? And so I think that where we are today is definitely a byproduct of that pivotal election. And that, you know, if you think about it, if Hillary had won, the system may have continued the way it was going.
Limping along
with obstruction, and, you know, think of how many more years we would have endured Benghazi if Hillary Clinton would have been elected. And I loved her and advocated for her. But do I think things worked out the way they were supposed to? I do. I don't believe there are mistakes. I believe that things happen for a reason, and that there's better times ahead because of the struggle.
Okay. So I guess one of the questions I would ask following that then is, one of the things that's kind of frustrating to me is seeing that how much death it did take to get to this point, and kind of between COVID and the death of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, it kind of, that was the thing that made all of this explode, really, because all of these people had so much frustration leading up to this moment. And I kind of, to me, that was really sad. And one of the people that I think put it best was Dave Chappelle, when he talked about the fact that, you know, this election that you were talking about was kind of like the Emmett Till moment in the civil rights era. And so his perspective was that moment changed a lot of minds, in being able to see that open casket and seeing that wound and seeing that pain is what caused a lot of people, a lot of white people, to just change their minds about what was happening in America. And so taking that forward, looking at the election of Donald Trump and looking at Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and any number of people, Philando Castile, you could just keep going on and on. There's just a list of names that people of color have that they can just rattle off at any given time. That's, you know, what Dave Chappelle said about that is probably, was at least to me, pretty poignant on the topic. So
I agree. I think he's one of our modern day truth tellers. I think he's, you know, brilliant. And I think that he does a lot of skewering of race and does some things that make a lot of people uncomfortable in order to get us to see some truths on both sides of the divide. And I think that's in line with kind of what I thought. It is this retweeting a video in which somebody is screaming white power does not happen by accident. That's the open casket. That is coming from someone who feels that they have this cover, that they have this strength by which they can do this, and the dog whistle moments. But we're all listening. We can all hear these whistles. We can all see it. And every day, you know, I think if Republicans, if the GOP had their way, you know, Hillary would have won and Trump wouldn't have, because what has happened has revealed all the secrets, all the shit, you know? So I agree.
Yeah. What does it mean for you to have a platform in a moment like this?
It's the responsibility to, you know, I've always been, my mom was a union leader. She was a public school teacher in inner city Detroit, and has always been outspoken. I've marched with her in protests and been on the picket line since I was a kid. And hold on a second. I'm sorry.
Sure.
Hopefully that goes away. Yay. I've been an advocate for what the things I believe in my whole life. I knew I was gay when I was 10, and it terrified me. And by the time I was 15, I couldn't take it anymore, and I had to come out because I was so tired of lying and I was so tired of hiding.
Sure.
And I didn't dream that we would come to this point in consciousness. I have faced racism from many different communities for who I am, for being mixed, for being too light, for being dark, for looking Puerto Rican. I've been, stopped and frisked. And, it's sort of this no man's land in a way. And there are other people out there like me who, from all walks of life, who can identify with that kind of struggle. And if I get the chance, being a gay actor, it's not easy, because when people know things about your personal life, it in their minds limits what you can, what you have the ability to do. We know this from just, you know, decades of Hollywood and actors feeling like they had to be in the closet. And for me, at a certain point, you know, right before Hamilton, I was ready to just give up anyway on the business. I really was. It was too hard. I was sleeping on the floor of my best friend's mom's attic in New Jersey. And I just didn't think I could keep going. So to get here and have a platform, I have to make a path for all the people like me and to speak out when I can and be vocal and be visible, because getting along and doing things that are commercial, you know, just for the money is not who I am and it's not what I believe in.
Sure.
So I really take it so seriously. And I've walked the walk for a while. And so now it's upon me to talk the talk if I get the chance, and be that voice for people out there who do not have a voice, for all those kids in Detroit who didn't get a scholarship to go to school or didn't happen to have the luck of going to New York at the right time to do the thing. I hope this gives them strength. And I hope that, you know, in watching the film, there's, you know, little gay, black, minority kids who see me voguing in Guns and Ships and are like, what? Rewind! and, you know, feel a part of it where they previously might have thought, oh, you know, Hamilton's not really for me. It's this macho thing. It's rap. And, you know, the rap community isn't really, you know, something that's, you know, super gay friendly. Well, sure. This is theater rap, A, and B, you've got a queen in the chorus who, whenever he gets a chance, is letting the girl out. So, you know, I'm trying to do my part. I'm trying to be the best I can, because I've always thought, as a person with a platform, people who have platforms, you do. You have a responsibility to represent.
Absolutely. So, Sydney, we talked about at the top of this interview that you had somewhere to be. I could honestly keep talking to you forever, so I'm not trying to kick you out, but I don't want to make you late for your next engagement, which is what again?
It is Hamamel Crossing.
I love it. So we talked about platforms. Are you on social media?
I am. I'm Sydney Harcourt on Instagram. I'm SydneyHarcourt.com. I'm Sydney James Harcourt on Facebook and Sydney Harcourt on Twitter.
That's fantastic. So hopefully our listeners and our readers will be able to find you wherever they can. And so Sydney, I appreciate you coming on the show. It was great talking to you.
Anytime, man. You want to have me back, we'll talk about games, we'll talk about geek stuff. I'm such a geek. We haven't even gotten into the whole fantasy thing that I'm like a part of, like fantasy books and Lord of the Rings and the whole nine yards.
So, I mean, so listen, you put yourself out there like that. You say that, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do the thing. I'm going to hit you up and be like, hey, listen, the new Lord of the Rings show is coming out. The, you know, Amazon's Fallout TV show is coming out. I'm going to hit you up and be like, what do you think is about Cyberpunk 2077?
Let's do it. Come on. Let's do it.
Can't wait.
I love it. Thank you so much. This was awesome.
Awesome. No problem. Have a good night.
All right. Bye, brother.
And I think we can leave it there. I certainly had a great time talking with Sydney, and you can catch him on Hamilton 4th of July weekend on Disney Plus. And if you like what you heard in this interview, you know how to do all the socials. Like, rate, subscribe, share. We definitely appreciate it. Also, check out LRM's other great content for your listening and reading pleasure on the website lrmonline.com. You can find me contributing to the website. You can also find me on Twitter at Sir Jonesius, and of course, right here on other episodes of Breaking Geek Radio, the podcast. Until next time, hasta lasagna, and don't get any.